Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on The Wire today...
Throwing away that protection for a cheap political stunt, as the Premier is doing, is a pretty obscene breach of our civil liberties.
Premier Gladys Berejiklian has announced today her government's intention to enact new laws to allow police to search the homes of convicted drug dealers without having to obtain a search warrant in New South Wales. But will this be the start of a slippery slope? Also on The Wire today, coming up...
We know that there are specific barriers that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people face to getting a driver's licence. And some of these barriers can include access to identity documents, so birth certificates, proof of residence, that kind of thing.
Many Indigenous people, particularly in remote areas, have to surmount significant obstacles to get a driver's licence. But with this being the major photo ID document that government and businesses use, what is being done to help these people? Stay tuned for all this and more coming up on The Wire. But first, in the wake of the horrific massacre committed by an Australian in Christchurch last week, the ways that racism and especially Islamophobic sentiment have been normalised have concerned politicians and media commentators alike. The sentiment expressed by the gunman Tarrant, who murdered 50 Muslims at prayer, has gained momentum here in Australia, and we are now at a crossroads. Victor Petrovic has more.
The massacre of 49 Muslim people at two different mosques in Christchurch has sparked a well overdue discussion in the gunman's home, Australia. The man, who moved across the ditch less than 3 years ago, is thought to have been heavily influenced by Islamophobic sentiment, which has developed here in Australia's political and media landscape, as was alluded to by the Mayor of Christchurch, Leanne Dalziel, when she spoke to the ABC earlier today.
Islamophobia, it doesn't belong here. It didn't start here. It's been imported here.
Australia is seen as a hotbed for Islamophobic sentiment, with politicians and media pundits cashing in on its popular appeal, dating back to the post-9/11 Tampa refugee crisis in 2001. Muslim leaders, like spokesperson for the Australian National Imams Council, Bilal Rauf, think this calls for a time of deep reflection.
The killer here, the terrorist here, was homegrown. He was Australian. He'd only been in New Zealand for a few years prior to this incident. And so I think we need to have a long, hard think about who we are and how we are perceived around the world.
Which is exactly what many in the media and political spheres have begun to do. Fringe ideas have become mainstream, and many influential voices in our democracy have aided Islamophobic and anti-migrant sentiments in getting there. Bilal Rauf says that this has the potential to tear our multicultural society apart.
We are a society which brings together people from so many different backgrounds, and our strength is in our unity and our standing together and identifying as Australians as a part of this society. And when you have these ideas that are, you know, raised by white supremacist groups and the messages normalised by politicians and media agencies, it strikes at the very fabric of our society and risks tearing it apart.
Politicians have used Islamophobic sentiment as a vote winner and normalised speech about Muslim Australians, which forces them into being the other. Professor Greg Barton from the Alfred Deakin Institute thinks that this language can have unintended consequences, like those witnessed in Christchurch on Friday.
I don't think people in government and public life intended for these bad consequences to manifest in the way they have or even foresaw them, but I'm suggesting that if these are the unintended consequences, they're still the consequences. And of course, no one wants something like the awful terrorist massacre in Christchurch, but we have to accept now that words matter, and if we play with the language of that effectively demonises the other, then we run the risk that it has very bad consequences.
And the conflating of issues of policy and race have become commonplace in Australian political debate. Professor Barton points to last month's Medivac bill as a prime example.
When you've got somebody as senior as a Prime Minister or a Home Affairs Minister saying we can't go with Labor's Medivac bill because people coming off Manus and Nauru are pedophiles and criminals, they will violently assault or represent a threat or even become a terrorist, a threat in Australia, when they know full well that that's not what ASIO and ASIS is telling them. That was just language for political expediency to try and drive a wedge between the government of the moment and the Labour opposition. But when you've got people at a senior level challenged by senior journalists sticking to this line that they know to be a fiction, then we can hardly be surprised if some of our more reckless senators come out with even worse language, and there's a sense that these things are permissible.
Bilal Rauf thinks that a cultural change is necessary, and we need to start by calling out hateful and divisive rhetoric.
We need to call out where there is speech or conduct which promotes hatred, which promotes vilification, which promotes division. We need to call that out and confront it, not just quietly tolerate it and in some cases promote it.
Spokesperson for the Australian National Imams Council, Bilal Rauf, ending that report by Viktor Petrovich.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
The New South Wales state election is set for January... The New South Wales state election is set for this coming Saturday the 23rd, and both major parties are still announcing policies. Premier Berejiklian and Police Minister Troy Grant are on Sunday revealing a new trial that gives police the power to search houses or cars of convicted drug dealers without a warrant. Nathaniel Keesing has more.
It's only 5 days until the New South Wales state election comes to a head, and parties are still announcing policies to try and sway voters to their side. The Coalition on Sunday announced a new trial giving police the power to search houses and cars of convicted drug dealers without a warrant. Professor Peter Norden of Deakin University and Fellow of the Australian and New Zealand Society of Criminology believe this trial is just another example of a failed attempt of the war on drugs.
We need to actually think carefully about social policies because they have costs, both financial and social. Already in New South Wales, there's 15,000 inmates in prison, and the New South Wales government's planning to build a further 7,000 prison cells, and that's at a cost of $110,000 per inmate per year. So, you know, you might think, well, this is all to actually win the war on drugs, but this approach that the Coalition in New South Wales seems to be approaching is just a further example of the ways in which the war on drugs has failed.
Meanwhile, Greens MP David Shoebridge believes allowing the police the power to search convicted drug offenders' homes without a warrant also infringes on individual freedom.
If the police have a case against somebody and have a valid reason, a reasonable suspicion that somebody is engaging in serious illegal activity, if that's commercial drug dealing or the like, well, then they need to go to a magistrate and show that evidence to a magistrate and persuade a magistrate to give them a warrant. That's the way the law has worked, not just the last few years. That's the way the law has worked for well over a century in our legal system. And throwing away that protection for a cheap political stunt, as the Premier is doing just before this general election, is a pretty obscene breach of our civil liberties by the Premier and by her entire party, the Liberal Party.
These new police powers will be trialled in the Hunter Valley, Bankstown, Coffs Clarence and the Orana Midwestern region. However, Professor Norden believes these areas are being unfairly targeted.
I do notice that the plan is being trialled in the Hunter Valley region, which is in fact, and a number of other regions, which reflect the most disadvantaged postcode areas in New South Wales by far. Now, those postcode areas are not necessarily the most criminal areas, but they're certainly the most policed areas. Now, I'm just thinking of, the capacity to raid houses of people who have been previously convicted, perhaps 10 years ago, what the circumstances would be for the young children growing up in those homes. And now, the law has checks and balances, and over the years, those checks and balances have worked in our community's favour. So I just feel that this is another example on the eve of an election, getting tough on crime, war on drugs. But do the community realise that, you know, the constant increase in prison numbers in New South Wales is actually taking money away from those disadvantaged areas where they could be invested in education, in housing, in health services, in transport. So to single out this idea that you could raid houses of families where there is one person living there who's had a prior conviction, possibly 10 years ago, without thinking of the impact on those particular communities is not particularly good policy. But it might be successful in winning a few votes. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's good governance around criminal justice policy.
Professor Peter Norden of Deakin University, ending that report by Nathaniel Keesing. The Ukrainian election is less than a month away, with the frontrunner a former television star made famous by playing a progressive president. It's Lights, Camera, Election. Max Tillman has the story.
It's a literal case of life imitating art. A comic actor who scored a ratings hit playing a pretend Ukrainian president on TV suddenly finds himself the real-life frontrunner for president as voters prepare to head to the polls on the 31st of March. Volodymyr Zelensky, star of Servant of the People, a mockumentary series documenting the trials of a schoolteacher-turned-populist president, has the preference of 25% of Ukrainians, according to a poll conducted by Ukrainian rating agency Rating, with incumbent President Poroshenko a distant second, with 17% of Ukrainians having faith in his administration, with Europe's only active war still underway in the east with Russia. It's been 5 years since mass protests in the Ukraine sparked a democratic revolution in the name of democracy and transparency, deposing the country's corrupt pro-Russian president Viktor Yanukovych. If opinion polls in the Ukraine are even close to accurate, Mr. Zelensky could be the Ukraine's next leader at a pivotal time in their modern history. It was Oscar Wilde who once said, "Life imitates art more than art imitates life." But with Soviet rule having ended 28 years ago, has the cult of the personality become the cult of the celebrity? Chairman of the Australian Federation of Ukrainian Organisations and Vice President of the Ukrainian World Congress, Stefan Romanov, says that despite a lead candidate straight out of the television, the Ukrainian people are voting on a simple platform of who they believe can defend the country against Russian aggression. If Mr. Poroshenko is unseated, a new leader in the capital of Kiev could revive stalled negotiations to end Europe's only war, in which more than 13,000 people have died since Russian-backed forces seized control of eastern Ukraine in 2014.
When you vote, you have to understand you're voting either for Ukraine or you're voting anti-Ukraine in terms of supporting Russia. So you're either going to Russia or you're going to Europe.
But for a country still new to democracy, the appeal of a fresh face with broad recognisability has taken a turn familiar to Western democracies, with political fatigue setting in as scandals and corruption continue to plague the Ukraine 5 years after democratic protests led to the ousting of Viktor Yanukovych.
People are looking for something different. People are looking, you look at America, I mean, they voted in Trump. They were looking for something different. They weren't happy with what was there. I think from Zelensky's point of view, obviously, being a person who is in the limelight, a person who's out there to, as a celebrity, the celebrity factor has some input.
While Zelensky may seem different to other politicians, he still keeps strong ties to the country's oligarchs, who dictate much of the political discourse.
You know, one of the biggest problems in Ukraine today in terms of media is, you know, who owns the media outlets.
His popular television shows were broadcast on the television channel of Ihor Kolomoisky, the oligarch embroiled in a sprawling banking bailout scandal involving Privat Bank that cost the Ukraine $5.6 billion, a staggering expense for a country whose government is propped up by loans from the International Monetary Fund.
Many of the oligarchs own the media outlets. He who pays, you know, he orders the music. So from that point of view, yes, I mean, I think it's an issue for everybody that ultimately there has to be that transparency about who is supporting who. And then, you know, there's nothing like a free lunch. So if Kolomoisky is supporting him or anybody else or anybody supporting anybody, what they should be outlining is what am I expecting to get in return?
Since independence in 1991, many of the Soviet characteristics have lingered on in the Ukraine. Professor Alexei Moraviev, Russian himself, head of the Department of Social Sciences and Security Studies at Curtin University, sees echoes of Ukraine's 70 years of satellite status in the country's modern socio-political landscape.
The Ukrainians, just like many other nationalities across the Soviet Union, continue to carry on enormous influence of Soviet inheritance.
Whilst modern democracy emphasises the laws of the many over the few, figures like Zelensky still show that as the Ukraine wrestles with Russia over its eastern borders and struggles with corruptions within its political ranks, the desire for a strong singular figure to steady the ship is still present, even if people must reach into their televisions to find it.
There is no doubt that the remnants of the former, Soviet Union still remains. The question is, where was it 25 years ago and how strong was it 25 years ago and how strong is it today?
Stefan Romanev, Ukrainian World Congress Vice President, ending that story by Max Tillman.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
Indigenous people living in regional rural Australia typically have higher rates of road accidents and fatalities, which can also lead to higher incarceration rates. A recent survey led by researchers from the University of New South Wales, Sydney, the George Institute and the University of Wollongong highlighted the need for more driving and road safety education for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, as well as looking at the barriers that Indigenous drivers face. Brendan Phillips has more.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people living in regional areas of Australia experience limited access to road safety and driving services. According to New South Wales Bureau of Crime and Research, in 2018, 54 Indigenous men and women were held in custody in New South Wales alone over traffic offences. Professor Patricia Cullen, Research Fellow at the School of Public Health and Community Medicine at the University of New South Wales, explains some of the challenges that Indigenous drivers face.
And while the data isn't 100% clear, we know that there are specific barriers that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people face to getting a driver's licence. And some of these barriers can include access to identity documents, so birth certificates, proof of residence, that kind of thing. And then there's also issues in terms of gaining access to a car and a supervisor to do supervised driving practice.
Cullen explains that programs implemented by government services is a major way to overcome these barriers.
Another one of the issues can be around the cost of licence testing fees, licensing fees, professional driving lessons, which are quite expensive as well. And then some issues around preparing for the learner test.
One of these programs is the Indigenous Driver Licensing Program located in Cairns that aims to reduce unlicensed driving in remote and Indigenous communities in far north Queensland. These areas include Cape York, the Gulf and Torres Strait Islands. Barry Lee, an instructor from the Indigenous Driving Licensing Unit in Cairns, is involved in the program and says that one major challenge he helps overcome is the lack of services available.
Basically, it was set up to combats the a lot of the communities with where there is no Department of Transport, and obviously no Department of Transport, so there's no way for them to get their licences, especially their learner licences, and go through to their provisionals, and of course we go up to heavy vehicle licences, just up to HR and HC.
Not having a licence also directly affects the ability to work, Lee explains.
It certainly opened up a lot of opportunities for them. Obviously, when you look at any job, whether it be mainstream or Indigenous, it's a massive plus in having your licence. So it opens up a whole new realm of opportunities for them with regards to jobs that they can actually go for.
One major challenge for these services, however, is government funding.
I mean, with any government department, with any agency, it's always a problem with the funding. But look, we make do with what we've got, and we look at the difference we make within the communities out there.
Professor Cullen again explains the need for funding in providing these services.
What needs to happen, though, is that we need to make sure that communities have ownership over these types of programs. and that there's strong engagement from the outset, and also that the funding is sustainable and long-term, so that communities don't spend time and resources establishing these programs only to lose funding and have the program closed down. That's really vital.
While work is being done, Cullen states that there needs to be more of a focus on acquiring identification for Indigenous Australians accurately.
It's really imperative that there's collection of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander identification accurately in state licensing databases. So to my knowledge, at this point in time, only New South Wales collects that information, but that's really important across states.
Professor Patricia Cullen from the School of Public Health and Community Medicine at the University of New South Wales there, ending that report by Brendan Phillips. Well, all this week on The Wire, we're going to be bringing you stories from the stage, performance artists who take on the issues of our time, and they're on at the Adelaide Fringe Festival. Today we're hearing from award-winning slam poet Alison Bennett, who's in her stage persona as Alison Paradox. She's been presenting the performance Floral Peroxide at the Adelaide Fringe. Alison uses poetry, film, electronic soundscapes, movement and visual art to explore the paradoxes of her own disability and the societal desire to fix the broken self.
The name I've sort of chosen as a stage persona, Alison Paradox, is that I feel that all humans, regardless of being disabled or able-bodied, we're all paradoxes. We all have very contrasting facets of our personalities.
Tiptoeing on eggshells with sledgehammers for shoes, she's a vacuumed-up rainbow.
I've got quite a complex health history. I was born with a genetic disease called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Well, there's steel rods and bolts in my spine from 312 of my vertebrae, and it creates an incredible amount of pain. But the other thing about hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos is that it is a connective tissue disease. So it affects basically every system in your body.
And the constant steam of blood tests to my bruised and swollen limbs are as gentle as gunfire in a library. A cricket bat to the head, a sledgehammer to a watermelon, a vacuum to a rainbow. My existence should have come with a warning label.
When you have disabilities and chronic health issues and chronic pain, there's always a side of you that's very confronting, sometimes very angry. But then we all have the other side of us that is the very soft, gentle, welcoming side. So Floral Peroxide is basically that summed up in a title, because it's two words that I felt were so contrasting. Floral was so gentle and passive, and peroxide so caustic and burning. And
though I never usually talk about my sickness with others, today I just couldn't.
To add further layers of complexity, I was involved in a house fire at the age of 4, suffered really, really bad burns to probably about 75% of my scalp, my head, so all my hair follicles on that part of my head were completely destroyed. So I had to have surgeries from the age of 4 up until the age of 15 in the craniofacial unit. So I grew up with what other people might consider deformity, and that was hidden very well. You know, I wore hats all the time, and it was always kind of something I kept secret as a teenager because there was a lot of shame around it for me. At the age of 18, I developed a severe eating disorder, anorexia, and that continued on for a good 20 odd years of my life. At my lowest point, I hit 25, 26 kilos. And I think the fact that I'm still standing here today, I feel incredibly blessed. But obviously, all of those things in combination have taken an incredible toll on my body as a 41-year-old woman. So from the outside, I might look like things are fine, but things on the inside really aren't. So for me, I think being able to express that pain in a way that was empowering and not just like, oh, poor me, my life's this shit, you know, because it's not. I've got really amazing things in my life. It's just that I have a lot of debilitating pain and current, like, constant hospitalizations and things. But you know what? I'm alive.
Alison Bennett there explaining her multimedia performance piece, Alison Paradox Presents Floral Peroxide, which has been on at the Adelaide Fringe, in that story by Malvika Hemanth. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or any Android app. The Wire is a team effort by 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide, and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. And you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. I'm Roderick Chambers. Thanks for your company.
You're trying to fail.